Chapter 9. I had never seen so many of these savages to jeer. Their lances seemed as numerous as stalks of grass. Their hoarse voices made a vast, inarticulate sound like the murmur of the sea. My friend Pagel was swearing to himself. Well, then go to the devil. ... he shouted, exasperated. But as I swung round he repented, for I heard him say hurriedly, shoot the fool's horse, before he gets away. ... he had good marksmen. Two shots rang out, and in the very act of turning my horse staggered, fell and lay still, as if struck by lightning. I had my feet out of the stirrups and rolled clear of him, but I did not attempt to rise. Neither dared they rush out to drag me in. The masses of Indians had begun to move upon the fort. They rode up in squadrons, trailing their long chusos, then dismounted out of musket shot, and, throwing off their fur mantles, advanced naked to the attack, stamping their feet and shouting in cadence. A sheet of flame ran three times along the face of the fort without checking their steady march. They crowded right up to the very stakes, flourishing their broad knives. But this palisade was not fastened together with hide lashings in the usual way, but with long iron nails, which they could not cut. Dismayed at the failure of their usual method of forcing an entrance, the heathen, who had marched so steadily against the musketry fire, broke and fled under the volleys of the besieged. Directly they had passed me on their advance I got up, and rejoined Gasparuz on a low ridge which jutted out upon the plain. The musketry of his own men had covered the attack, but now at a sign from him a trumpet sounded the ceasefire. ... together we looked in silence at the hopeless rout of the savages. It must be a siege then, ... he muttered. And I detected him wringing his hands stealthily. But what sort of siege could it be? Without any need for me to repeat my friend Pagel's message, he dared not cut the water off from the besieged. They had plenty of meat. And, indeed, if they had been short he would have been too anxious to send food into the stockade had he been able. But, as a matter of fact, it was we on the plain who were beginning to feel the pinch of hunger. Panelio, the Indian chief, sat by our fire folded in his ample mantle of guanaco skins. He was an athletic savage, with an enormous square shock head of hair resembling a straw beehive in shape and size, and with grave, surly, much-lined features. In his broken Spanish he repeated, growling like a bad-tempered wild beast, that if an opening ever so small were made in the stockade his men would march in, and get the Sonora not otherwise. Gasparuz, sitting opposite him, kept his eyes fixed on the fort night and day as it were, in awful silence and immobility. Meantime, by runners from the lowlands, that arrived nearly every day, we heard of the defeat of one of his lieutenants, in the Maipu Valley. Scouts sent afar broad news of a column of infantry advancing through distant passes to the relief of the fort. They were slow, but we could trace their toilful progress up the lower valleys. I wondered why Ruse did not march, to attack and destroy this threatening force, in some wild gorge fit for an ambuscade, in accordance with his genius for guerrilla warfare. But his genius seemed to have abandoned him to his despair. It was obvious to me that he could not tear himself away from the site of the fort. I protest to you, sinners, that I was moved almost to pity by the sight of this powerless strong man sitting on the ridge, indifferent to sun, to rain, to cold, to wind, with his hands clasped round his legs, and his chin resting on his knees, gazing. And the fort he kept his eyes fastened on was as still and silent as himself. The garrison gave no sign of life. They did not even answer the desultory fire directed at the loopholes. One night, as I strolled past him, he, without changing his attitude, spoke to me unexpectedly. I have sent for a gun, ... he said. I shall have time to get her back and retreat before your obols manages to crawl up here. ... he had sent for a gun to the plains. It was long in coming, but at last it came. It was a 7-pounder field gun. dismounted and lashed crosswise to two long poles. It had been carried up the narrow paths between two mules with ease. His wild cry of exultation at daybreak, when he saw the gun escort emerge from the valley, rings in my ears now. But, sinners, I have no words to depict his amazement, his fury, his despair and distraction, when he heard that the animal loaded with the gun carriage had, during the last night march, somehow or other tumbled down a precipice. He broke into menaces of death and torture against the escort. I kept out of his way all that day, lying behind some bushes, and wondering what he would do now. Retreat was left for him, but he could not retreat. I saw below me his artillerist, George, an old Spanish soldier, building up a sort of structure with heaped up saddles. The gun, ready loaded, was lifted onto that, but in the act of firing the whole thing collapsed, and the shot flew high above the stockade. Nothing more was attempted. One of the Ammonitian mules had been lost too, and they had no more than six shots to fire, ample enough to batter down the gate providing the gun was well laid. This was impossible without it being properly mounted. There was no time nor means to construct a carriage. Already every moment I expected to hear Obel's bugle calls echo amongst the cracks. Panilio, wandering about uneasily, draped in his skins, sat down for a moment near me growling his usual tale. Make an entrada a hole. If make a hole, bueno. If not make a hole, then vamos, we must go away. After sunset I observed with surprise the Indians making preparations, as if for another assault. Their lines stood ranged in the shadows of the mountains. On the plain in front of the fort gate I saw a group of men swaying about in the same place. I walked down the ridge disregarded. The moonlight in the clear air of the uplands was bright as day, but the intense shadows confused my sight, and I could not make out what they were doing. I heard the voice of George, the artillerist, say in a queer, doubtful tone, "It is loaded, senor." Then another voice in that group pronounced firmly the words, "Bring the riata here." It was the voice of Gaspar Ruiz. A silence fell, in which the popping shots of the besieged garrison rang out sharply. They, too, had observed the group. But the distance was too great, and in the spatter of spent musket balls cutting up the ground, the group opened, closed, swayed, giving me a glimpse of busy stooping figures in its midst. I drew near, doubting whether this was a weird vision, a suggestive and insensate dream. A strangely stifled voice commanded, "Haul the hitches tighter." Sigh, senor. Several other voices answered in tones of odd alacrity. Then the stifled voice said, "Like this. I must be free to breathe." Then there was a concerned noise of many men together. "Help him up, hombres. Steady. Under the other arm." That deadened voice ordered. "Bueno. Stand away from me, men." I pushed my way through the recoiling circle, and heard once more that same oppressed voice saying earnestly, "Forget that I am a living man, George. Forget me altogether, and think of what you have to do. Be without fear, senor. You are nothing to me, but a gun carriage, and I shall not waste a shot." I heard the spluttering of a port fire, and smelt the saltpeter of the match. I saw suddenly before me a nondescript shape on all fours like a beast, but with a man's head drooping below a tubular projection over the nape of the neck, and the gleam of a rounded mass of bronze on its back. In front of a silent semicircle of men it squatted alone, with George behind it, and a trumpeter motionless, his trumpet in his hand, by its side. George, bent double, muttered, "Port fire in hand. An inch to the left, senor. Too much. So. Now, if you let yourself down a little, by letting your elbows bend, I will." He leaped aside, lowering his port fire, and a burst of flame darted out of the muzzle of the gun lashed on the man's back. Then Gaspar Ruiz lowered himself slowly. Good shot? Apostrophe apostrophe he asked. Full on, senior. Apostrophe apostrophe, then load again. Apostrophe apostrophe, he lay there before me on his breast under the darkly glittering bronze of his monstrous burden, such as no love or strength of man had ever had to bear in the lamentable history of the world. His arms were spread out, and he resembled a prostrate penitent on the moonlit ground. Again I saw him raised to his hands and knees, and the men stand away from him, and old George stoop glancing along the gun. Left a little. Right an inch. Poor Dios, senior, stop this trembling. Where is your strength? Apostrophe, the old gunner's voice was cracked with emotion. He stepped aside, and quick as lightning brought the spark to the touch hole. Excellent. Apostrophe, apostrophe, he cried, tearfully. But Gasparuz lay for a long time silent, flattened on the ground. I am tired, apostrophe, he murmured at last. Will another shot do it? Apostrophe, apostrophe, without doubt, apostrophe, said George, bending down to his ear. Then load, apostrophe, I heard him mutter distinctly. Trumpeter. Apostrophe, apostrophe, I am here, senior, ready for your word. Apostrophe, apostrophe, blow a blast at this word, that shall be heard from one end of Chile to the other, apostrophe, he said, in an extraordinarily strong voice. And you others stand ready to cut this accursed riata, for then will be the time for me to lead you in your rush. Now raise me up, and you, George, be quick with your aim. Apostrophe, apostrophe, the rattle of musketry from the fort nearly drowned his voice. The palisade was wreathed in smoke and flame. Exert your force forward against the recoil, mi amo, apostrophe, said the old gunner, shakily. Dig your fingers into the ground. So. Now. Apostrophe, a cry of exultation escaped him after the shot. The trumpeter raised his trumpet nearly to his lips and waited. But no word came from the prostrate man. I fell on one knee, and heard all he had to say then. Something broken, apostrophe, he whispered, lifting his head a little, and turning his eyes towards me in his hopelessly crushed attitude. The gate hangs only by the splinters, apostrophe, yelled George. Gasparuz tried to speak, but his voice died out in his throat, and I helped to roll the gun off his broken back. He was insensible. I kept my lips shut, of course. The signal for the Indians to attack was never given. Instead, the bugle calls of the relieving force for which my ears had thirsted so long burst out, terrifying like the call of the last day to our surprised enemies. A tornado, centers, a real hurricane of stampeded men, wild horses, mounted Indians, swept over me as I cowered on the ground by the side of Gasparuz, still stretched out on his face in the shape of a cross. Pinilio, galloping for life, jabbed at me with his long chuso in passing for the sake of old acquaintance, I suppose. How I escaped the flying lead is more difficult to explain. Venturing to rise on my knees too soon, some soldiers of the 17th Total Regiment, in their hurry to get at something alive, nearly bayoneted me on the spot. They looked very disappointed too, when, some officers galloping up drove them away with the flat of their swords. It was General Robles with his staff. He wanted Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.